Oh, right. Hi.
Hi.
I was reading dialogue boxes.
Oh, those are always fun. Was it anything pertinent to Interstellar?
No, not at all. No.
Oh, what are the odds?
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
All right. I think I have a smoked meats hangover. Mostly because I think I have smoke inhalation poisoning.
Oh, so you were also being smoked while the meat was being smoked?
Yeah, I mean, as a helicopter parent of my first ever smoked piece of meat in the backyard, I think I stuck my face in the smoke a few too many times, and I think I kind of gave myself a headache that lasted 2 days.
Oh, I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to do that.
No, I don't think so.
Because I think you need oxygen to breathe, maybe.
Well, you only need a minimal amount of oxygen to have the coals stay on. So that's about how much oxygen I had. And okay. That was that.
Yeah. Well, you know, our atmosphere is also made up of nitrogen, and the blight is going to contribute to the.
So you're fresh back from seeing Interstellar, and you're super angry and ready to tear it to shreds.
No, that's not accurate. Actually, there are a lot of things in it that I really like, and there's a lot of things in it that I really don't like at all. There's sort of this is going to sound very predictable of me to say this, but it's a little indulgent, which is a criticism I often level at Christopher Nolan, and it still holds true. Can't edit himself at all. Not even a little.
Well, we'll get to that at some point, I think. But I think there's actually some things that did actually get edited out. But I don't know how we would find that out. Should we do some follow-up?
Yes. I don't remember what it is, so remind me. I'm sure it's going to be interesting.
Well, there's some small topics that I thought we should bring up. We got our Flame follow up that we discussed on Twitter, going back and forth jokingly, but we talked about Flame being a non-floating point processing, or at least partially floating point, and it turns out it is half float in general, and there may be one tool that is fully float, but in general it doesn't really work, and Flame is still 16-bit half float, so go figure.
Yeah, and for the audience members that don't know what that is, it's just a rounding error. So. No,
like
I'm just
that
kidding.
One, like that one Pentium that they sold a whole bunch of and then had to recall?
Yes. No, it was not exactly like that. But so half float, you're basically just chopping off a bunch of the decimal numbers from the end of your float number, and that's why it's half, because it's small.
We also got some what if the Earth stops spinning feedback, and I take a little bit of issue with some of this. I don't know if you looked at any of the – there was an article and there was a video talking about – what would actually happen if the Earth stopped spinning? And this was our discussion about the Superman versus the Flash relay race, and if they ran in opposite directions, stopping the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Did
familiar.
You watch the video or read the article?
I did, and I think it speaks for itself. People think other things will happen, and so that's fine. I don't really care.
Well, the one thing that bothered me about it is all of those predictions were based on the premise that the Earth would stop. In an instant, it would go from spinning to dead stop at the snap of your fingers. And that's where all of the flying people and 1,000-mile-an-hour winds and all of that would come from. But I think if we were having our relay race, they would sort of slowly be fighting against each other. Then the Earth would come to a more gradual stop. So I think some of those issues with the gravitation changes would be present. But I don't think everyone would instantly die in the same way that those videos were describing.
Okay, but probably not. A good outcome.
No, good things would not happen to the human race or animals, but it wouldn't be instant death for everyone. There would probably be at least, you know, a half hour of people wondering why they feel funny.
So Flash and Superman, don't do that.
Yeah,
the end.
We'll make sure to send them a memo on that. We also got some direct feedback about the relay race from your friend Jason the Roboticist that... while I took away Thor's hammer from you, I kept Green Lantern's ring and Ari Gold's BlackBerry, so that's not fair ground.
Yeah, but like you pointed out on Twitter, I didn't actually call you on it when it happened.
Well,
so
that's
it
just me making excuses.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's too late now, Dan. That podcast episode has sailed.
Yeah, whatever. It's like a week and a half old at this point, and there's literally nothing that can be done about it.
Nope, never. Not at least not with computers.
Apparently, it's not entirely accurate that we called out Bonanza for being wrong. They didn't greatly appreciate that. So
yeah, those guys. I kind of like how the last episode of Bionic mentions our show, and then the first three episodes of Bonanza have mentioned our show every time, and we've mentioned their show every time. So we just keep ping ponging back and forth in like this giant inside joke.
Yeah.
Which I don't even know if any of our audience is listening to both things and is like following along to see what happens every week.
Probably a portion of it, but I don't think they're as gripped by the back and forth as we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's because I greatly enjoy having some British people that can, you know, contribute a couple of ideas to the world at large. And even if they're wrong about things, that's fine.
Although apparently we are the ripoff show, not them.
Mm-hmm.
Although technically we're older than Bonanza, so we could retcon that a little bit and just kind of.
Yeah, but yeah. We're not older than Bionic.
Well, we don't have they don't talk about it, so mm-hmm. let's stop talking about it and pretend it never existed, just like they do, and suddenly we're older.
Yeah, or we can just go through a black hole.
Well, that's
how good are you at Morse code, Dan?
I know there are dots and there are dashes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all.
Why is it always Morse code?
All right, isn't there, I think there's an iOS 8 keyboard extension that you can type a messaging in Morse code.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah, I think it was more of a proof of concept, but somebody made like a telegraph interface that you can actually write messages in Morse code for some reason.
Yeah, well, there's one of those iOS word processor writing apps that is a fake typewriter.
Oh, I totally have that one.
Oh, God. Why?
It's not really a word processor. It's more just for like making artsy, self-indulgent nonsense that has like three catchy words on it that you post on Facebook or something.
It's the Christopher Nolan of keyboards.
No, it is not the Christopher Nolan of keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, so before we get into the movie, though, there was another thing I wanted to mention, which is that Sony Pictures was hacked. And at first I was like, oh, guys, this is lousy. Like, it must have just been the main lot, Sony Pictures Entertainment main lot. Because it's a organization that has tons of little sub-companies and stuff like that, you know. So the Sony that does life insurance in Tokyo, unaffected. The Sony that does electronics, also unaffected. The Sony that does entertainment, totally affected. And it seems that they're... is an ongoing thing of whether or not they will totally release this data, but apparently they have a file list of all the stuff that they took, and they released the names on the files. And there's totally files there with my name on them, as well as people I know. It was forwarded to me, and it's legit stuff. Like they would not have just randomly made these things up. Like there's a t-shirt order form for a movie with a internal abbreviation of a movie name on it. So it's just like, okay, so that's definitely not something they just randomly, you know, put in a word generator or something with a list of names. And it's a little troubling that this went out because it may or may not, if they release stuff, it may or may not contain personal information. Now, it might just be like... pay rates and stuff like that, or it might also be things like home addresses and social security numbers. We'll find out. I think that's going to be exciting, and totally not thrilled about it. And Sony's official stance on this is that they experienced a disruption. So that's also comforting when you have like leaked screenshots of like how the systems are still down and stuff like that, and these file names circulating. It's like, oh yeah, disruption. Totally that. Totes.
Do we yet know who did this and why? Do they have any demands?
No, it's that apparently it's hashtag GOP, which does not stand for Grand Old Party. But it is another GOP I don't like. Go figure. And this group or couple people or something claims to have corresponded with the media and told them they had inside help. But who knows? Who's to say at this point?
But do we know why they did this? There was some rumor going back and forth that this was kind of a way to hold a company to the fire for the way they're mistreating employees. I don't know that any of that was ever founded.
Well, there's this thing that like I mentioned, they claim to have contacted the media, and what they said they were after was equality, which is sort of a head scratcher when you think about it. But this information that they took is mainly HR stuff, like contracts, like pay rates, all kinds of that's stuff.
Probably just the stuff they could actually get their hands on.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that was just the stuff that they could get their hands on, if that was a target of theirs or something, but it is all, like, HR stuff. And it's, like, Roland Emmerich's, like, visa or green card application is in there or something. Because, I mean, he you know, works with Sony Pictures a lot. And, like, Cameron Diaz has stuff in there. It actually includes some stars and important people, as well as, like, all of the executives, of which there are too many, and, you know, what they make and stuff like that. But I don't understand how releasing information on, like, the peons, like me or anybody else, benefits anybody. So let's not do that equality thing, you bozos. I don't think that's good.
If they were, in fact, using that information as potential leverage, that would be a pretty clear indication that they don't really know how the company is set up. So being an inside job would kind of be out of the question at that point, I would think. But what do I know?
Who knows? They'll probably just dump all the information on the internet, and I'll just have some identity theft that'll just recur for the next 40 years or something. It'll be exciting. Let's see how it goes.
I mean, you know, you gotta keep life. You gotta spice it up every now and then. Keep it interesting. So, you know, maybe it's a blessing in disguise.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not. It's probably a terrible thing, but, you know, it could be a blessing.
It's just a reminder to update my go bag, all my fake passports, you know, the usual stuff.
I mean, these days, who doesn't just work under a fake name?
Mm-hmm. All right, well, how do you know Joseph Rosensteel is even my real name?
Well, it's not. You're Joe Steele.
Mm-hmm. How do you know Joe Steele is even a name?
It's not a name. It's fake.
Mm-hmm. It just goes down like this, Dan.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it's just
maybe that's what this whole thing was. They were trying to get to your actual real identity.
Yes, it's just a fan of the show.
No, I think it's because you are in fact Jason Bourne, and they want to find out who your real identity is.
No. Jason Bourne was a captain, doctor, man, guy.
I secretly loved that his name was Man.
Mm-hmm. You're such a freakish Merlin aficionado.
I want somebody to write some fanfic where he is Merlin's, like, second cousin or something.
Don't look at me.
That's your job, isn't it?
To write fanfic? I haven't done that in, like, a year.
Well, you better get back up on that horse. That,
I know.
That fanfic podcast horse.
I have so much stuff that I've been meaning to write, and I have no time. Like, even, like, dumb blog posts and things. Like, I was going to write about the Sony thing on the blog, and I may do it after this, but certainly not before this episode posts, just because it's just so much time. So instead, I spent that, like, talking about Siri and Touch ID. So, of course, I got my priorities all straight in a line of priorities.
You'd equality. Probably have more time to write podcast screenplays if you weren't busy watching 169-minute long Christopher Nolan movies.
Yes. Or watching the first three Star Trek movies on Thanksgiving.
I honestly thought they were going to suspend your account for spam.
Mm-hmm.
How many tweets did you send out last
night?
I
have no idea.
300?
Yeah, probably.
Every single one of them with a photo of your TV.
Yes, yes, yes. And I hope everyone appreciates that I also took them all at an angle. It's just really terrible. And it's worth going back and reflecting on the ridiculousness of Star Trek and its contributions to the space franchise market. Regardless of your feelings on J.J. Abrams or anything else, I still think there's some interesting stuff to be seen. 1 and 3 are both clearly messes, and 2 is a lot of fun. So that's my stance on that.
I thought you were going to go all the way through them, and you just kind of blacked out after the third one.
No, I was actually kind of tired because it was late at that point.
Yes, it was. Yes. It's been going for a very long time.
Yeah, well, 3 of those is a lot to get through, especially when the third one's such a downer. But yeah, that's it.
Well, that was some valuable internet content that people could consume.
Yeah, it's very cold in space.
I'm sure that's a reference to something.
Do you know the Klingon proverb that tells us revenge is a dish that is best served cold? It is very cold in space.
But, cool, yeah. I'm sure space is cold. Mm-hmm. High five for cold space. Mm-hmm. It's warm in here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's good. Phoenix.
Yeah, it's 80 degrees right now.
Do you guys get the Santa Ana winds or whatever they call it? The weather stuff?
I don't know what that is.
Oh, it's an LA thing. When I first moved to the town and somebody said, oh, it's the Santa Ana winds, I was just like, I don't know if you're just making up something right now. Like, it's like a ghost or something that just swoops into town. But apparently there's some sort of like hot wind thing that comes into the LA region from the Santa Ana direction, so, or something, and that happens, and so a lot of times people will be like, oh, Santa Ana winds, it'll be like, yep, hot outside, yep, and it's just like, I don't understand that, but whatever. And it's also like the marine layer and stuff like that, like all of the fun basin-based weather we get. No frozen clouds, though.
Mm-hmm. Frozen clouds.
Mm-hmm. Frozen eye clouds.
No, we don't get any of that. The stuff that was witnessed on Earth in Interstellar, the giant sandstorms.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was almost entirely based off of the reference haboobs that we get here.
That's just a funny word.
That is what they're called. Congratulations for being 12.
I know. Like, you didn't laugh the first time you heard it. But the I still remember that video you took of your backyard, and it looked like hell. And then you had your poor little dog wandering around in the backyard. I was like, save the dog, you idiot.
Yeah, that was right as the storm was hitting. That one was a little bit more monsoony than just the classic haboob, because when the haboob comes in, it's not always giant wind. It's just a very large cloud of dust engulfs everything and leaks into the door seals at restaurants. And
it's a little side haboob?
Interstellar. what did you think of it? Just in general. Let's start from the top.
Okay. I did not like starting with the fake documentary and the while it didn't make any sense at the time that I first saw that first scene of like the dust falling and like the little toy rocket ship in the old shelf and stuff like that, it perfectly ties in later on in the film, and so I remember seeing that shot when we revisit it later. But it's such a slow start. The crisis that the Earth is in is spelled out in a nice way that does not bombard us with like a crawl of text. And we don't have like one character wandering in and saying everything that's happened in 10 years. Because those are always my least favorite things.
We don't actually know what year it is in this movie, do we? Nobody gets specific about that kind of stuff, do they?
No, of course not. Because then you'd have like a bunch of nerds on the internet in 20 years going, oh, it's the year that this happened. And it's not like this. It's not like the future. Nerds. like the eugenics war, but it's another matter. Also a lot of sand. But the so we're in sort of like a dust bowl situation, which is interesting. I'm not even entirely sure where in the United States this is, but I'm going to guess maybe somewhere in Kansas or Nevada or something, or I have no idea. Maybe Central Valley, California, though it seems unlikely with, given the climate. But I think that is also one of those things that's intentionally left blank. And the
it's got to be within driving distance to a NASA bunker, though.
Yeah.
That little part was funny. Like, I don't call it a plot hole or anything in particular, but I just thought it was funny that, all right, kids, hop in the truck. We're going to NASA. We're gonna go follow these coordinates that were on the ground. But anyway, but I mean, in general, did you like the movie before we start dissecting what worked and what didn't?
Oh, do I have to give a thumbs up or thumbs down on it, or can I give equivocate?
You can give a nuanced opinion.
Okay. It's worth seeing it, but I can't possibly recommend that anyone buy this movie or see it in a theater. I think that it is something that should be watched at home on your own schedule when you have time to deal with it. I think that the movie demands too much of you to sit there and endure ponderous ponderous time-wasting shots and a total scatterbrain list of ideas that are thrown about.
So you're suggesting it be watched in shifts?
Yeah, or well, not just not necessarily shifts, but at least like when you know, like if you have to go to the bathroom, you could pause it. Like I was very careful in the amount of liquid that I consumed before I went to go see the movie. I went to the bathroom before I stood in line. I made sure that I, while I was thirsty, I wasn't going to get any more water. I was a little parched. Maybe dehydration might have something to do with my feelings about the movie, but I doubt it. It's just at 3 hours, like I don't understand. And you tack onto that, like all of the time of going to the movie theater and everything. And even with the, 2 additional hours of like bonus time on the at the parking garage from getting your movie ticket validated and your 2 hours of free base time you get for free anyways, that's 4 hours, and I still had to pay $1 when I left the parking garage.
you should see movies in Arizona where everything's a parking lot and you don't have to pay for parking.
Yeah, well then I'd be covered in haboobs.
Only for a couple months out of the year.
Oh, okay. Seasonal haboobs?
It's very seasonal, yes. Okay. It's the end of the summer thing. Hmm. Yeah, I saw this in 70mm IMAX, which apparently is not all around the United States here, but this was one of the few places that they were actually showing the 70mm projection of it. I don't go to the theater nearly as much as I would like to, but I do try and enjoy those experiences when I do, because I think it is, I think there is something to it. There's an enjoyment that you can get out of a theater viewing that you don't get watching at home. That said, I do watch a lot of things at home, and it's a different experience that I also enjoy. But I liked seeing this one in IMAX, particularly because this is the first one of Christopher Nolan's mixed IMAX 35mm movies that I actually saw in IMAX. I didn't see Dark Knight or Dark Knight Rises in IMAX. I saw them in the theaters, but I didn't get a chance to see them in this fun, odd aspect ratio changing film projected version, just as the creator had intended. So now I feel I've seen it exactly how it was supposed to be presented to me in the way Christopher Nolan wanted. And I have a much more valid opinion on the things he claims are better and worse for the viewer than I did before, just as somebody who knew the technical details and was speculating on that experience. So
okay.
I enjoyed the experience of seeing this in the theater. I can understand what you're saying about not wasting your time or money, but if you are the kind of person who enjoys a theatrical experience, seeing this in IMAX is certainly interesting. You know, I wouldn't, if I had seen it just regular digitally projected on a normal screen, I could probably have that same opinion. But seeing it in IMAX was fun, probably because it was the first time I had done something like this.
Okay. I'll come at it from another angle. I saw it apparently 4K Sony digitally projected on a regular theater screen, not even like a super huge one. Standard stadium seating with no reserve seats, so everyone kept asking me if the seat next to me was available and the seat on the other end was available and if I wouldn't mind moving down a seat, and I kept saying, no, somebody's actually sitting there, don't you see the jacket? So that was always fun.
Yeah, our IMAX theater doesn't have reserve seating, which was interesting. And the have you seen many IMAX films, like actual IMAX?
I think I've only seen documentaries in IMAX.
Yeah, me too.
When I say in IMAX, I mean things that were properly shot in IMAX. I'm not talking about things that are blown up. I've seen The Hobbit. I know, not The Hobbit. Was it Lord? Was either The Fellowship of the Rings or Two Towers on IMAX? And that's just, you know, blowing up the movie really big. And I think I saw a replay of the first Matrix on a IMAX. I don't remember, but there was a period for a while in the 2000s where they were releasing everything in IMAX, quote unquote. And it was just scaling up the footage.
Yeah. I had only seen, I don't know, some like underwater documentary a million years ago in this IMAX theater. We only have the one around here, but, the screen, it, first of all, is, it looks like a big square. It's actually not square. It's like 1.4 to 1 ratio, which is almost square anyway. Yeah, we were slightly off center, and it's both like it's convex, one of those two. It's curved, yeah, as well as being the square, and just being slightly off center. We were probably like, you know, maybe 8 seats off center. It had this weird sort of angular distortion that I wouldn't really notice in a normal shaped screen, which I thought, you know, was interesting. And I don't know if that contributed to the experience at all, but I imagine it did a little bit, because there are some technical quibbles I had with the projection, or maybe it was the acquisition. It could be a combination of the two. But like the top right corner, which is the one that was furthest away from us, it was dim because, for whatever reason, probably because it was at a bit of an angle. But I imagine the IMAX experience is fantastic if you're the only person in that theater and you can pick the exact seat you want. But it still feels a bit like a Jurassic Park ride where you're getting some of the lowdown on the dino DNA and not so much a cinematic experience. And I don't know, I guess I could see why Christopher Nolan likes it if he's the all-controlling person sitting in the theater watching it. It's perfectly tuned to his sensibilities, but for a large movie going audience. And I was shocked. We saw it at 11 p.m. on, I think it was a weekend, but it was actually surprisingly full.
Yeah. Oh, the showing I went to tonight at 5, I'm sorry, this evening at 5, I showed up and I'd purchased my ticket on Fandango and got my convenience fee. Thanks, Fandango. And I got the ticket, and guy's like, oh, well, the line's outside. And they do that sometimes at this theater in Culver City, where you have to go stand, where they have these stanchions and a little paper sign that says the 5 o'clock showing of Interstellar. So I go over there and there's only 2 other people in front of me. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be empty. So this will go smoothly. And then everybody else piled in, and then everybody else crammed into the theater once they like released the stanchions, and they like tore tickets there, and then they sent you inside. But then they had made another line of other people waiting for Interstellar who didn't have tickets torn on the inside, which wasn't there before. So that was also fun, because then they had people just lining that, the people who had waited in line outside got to wait in line behind those people. And then getting into the theater, it was like a mad dash to like get a seat and lock it down, because it was such a small room. It was not one of the larger theaters that I've been in. Knowing that, I think that for sure it would be better if it was an ideal situation. Like if I went to the IPIC theater chain or something where they have like the recliners and all the crazy business where you're catered to, where versus something like this where you're just stuck like a sardine in a humanity can. You know, not to be too down on the movie going experience, but I find that it really brings very little to the table these days. And I agree with most of the American movie going public and that you should probably just stay home. and just watch stuff on TV, because screw movies.
Well, I like movies, and for a movie that was letting out at like 1:45 in the morning or whatever it was, I was surprised that the theater was as full as it was. And, you know, I could nitpick the hell out of the IMAX experience. Like, for one, looking around for seats, I almost like tripped and fell like 8 times because they have an irregular stair pattern. It's not like stair, 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 stair. It's like stair, stair, elongated stair, 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 elongated stair. And I almost like smashed my face 4 times on the way into the theater. But that's beside the point.
Well, I think that's also particular to the kind of theater that you're in, because I've also been to I've been to several different kinds of IMAX theaters, and so sometimes they're like stadium seating where it's at a really sharp angle, but but it's consistent, or sometimes it's at more of a, like a incline, like you're saying, or some of them are dome IMAX theaters, and those are weird.
we had a couple of those near our apartment in San Jose, and I could never go to one just because it looked so strange. It looked like a planetarium. It's like, why would I want to watch a movie in a planetarium?
Yeah, well, there's a movie theater that I still have not gone to in Hollywood called Cinerama.
Yeah.
Where it's a dome, like a planetarium-style dome, and it's projected on there, and they just show regular movies. It's not IMAX. And it's like, I think from the mid-50s or something where they built this thing. It is a bit of an icon or something, but I can't bring myself to watch anything like that because the distortion would just drive me crazy, like you're saying, even with regular IMAX. And I do notice that kind of distortion stuff too when you're not sitting exactly where you want to. Like I saw Open Season in 3D IMAX. Also, 3D IMAX actually really hurts my eyes. I don't know why. Can't explain it. I'm much better off with regular IMAX. I don't know what the deal is. I think the ghosting is worse because the screen is bigger.
Well, the larger screen, yeah, it fills your vision more, and you feel that a lot more if they're not careful.
Yeah.
I saw Pacific Rim in 3D at the it's not an actual IMAX theater, but the one at Universal CityWalk.
Mm-hmm.
We were kind of close center, and like that countdown they do, it does like a 15 second spinning countdown that comes out into your face. It hurt so much because it used every inch of the 3D depth, and it was going from infinity to like an inch from my face, and my eyes were just dying from the very beginning of the movie. But anyway, we're getting sidetracked.
Talking about a movie?
We were talking about Interstellar. So a couple other general things I wanted to ask you about before we get into the plot bits. Everyone's been talking about how the sound is ruined. Were you bothered by the sound, and did you take any issue with it in particular?
I was bothered by the sound infrequently. I took more of an issue with the score of the film. I didn't realize that Hans Zimmer was like, you know what, I'm going to be Philip Glass for the whole movie and we'll see what happens. Jerk.
So were your problems the same that other people are expressing, that you can't hear dialogue when you think you should be able to hear dialogue?
It's not as severe as I had expected going into it from the articles and stuff that have been written about it. I honestly thought maybe that is a little overplayed. However, I will say that there was in my row, there were 5 old people, and probably like, I don't know, septuagenarians, let's say. So maybe, you know, in their 70s. And so sometimes they would say something on screen and there was a lot of music or sound effects or something, and the old person would lean to the other old person and say, what did they say? And then they would tell them.
That's a fun experience to have.
God.
Well, I had a different experience in that a guy about 6 people over was snoring loudly for about half of the movie. But now that might take me out if I was surrounded by old people who kept asking each other what they had heard.
Well, it didn't happen that often. It was they were trying to whisper. But it was just an observation that is entertaining. But yeah, I didn't like the sound mixing, but I don't think it was as severe as I had imagined it to be. What are your feelings?
I immediately knew what people were talking about when there's that first brief scene. It's right up in the beginning there, where Matthew McConaughey is having his nightmare dream about the crash flashback scene. And it's really loud background noise. And I think there's even a little bit of music in there. He's screaming something into the microphone because he's clearly crashing, trying to talk to the ground or whatever. But you can't hear what he's saying at all. But you're not supposed to. And it doesn't make a difference whether you can hear what he's saying or not. It's really just about the chaos of that particular dream in that moment. And I could see where people would say, well, hey, I can't hear what he's saying. That's kind of annoying. But that was entirely intentional, in my opinion. And I didn't take issue with it at all. I think there were maybe one or two other moments where there was some chaotic space action where they were flying around, where the background noise slash music also rose up quite loudly and sort of it almost made the dialogue indiscernible, but I could still hear what they were saying, and I wasn't bothered by it because it all seemed completely intentional, and it was not offensive to me. They was very loud in a lot of parts, which is fine. I'm okay with loud mixes.
Well, I think, like you're saying, I think it's mainly, for me, an issue of the loudness and a lack of balance or restraint. It didn't ruin the experience, but it does take me out when I'm like, wow, why is this so loud?
Well, it is kind of the audio version of what he's doing with IMAX and 35, right? Because he's mixing his 35 millimeter anamorphic stuff when he wants to, and then he goes crazy with the gigantic IMAX shots when he wants a real spectacle. And he's kind of doing the same thing with the audio, where it's normal for normal parts of the movie, but when he really wants to hit you in the face with something, he'll go full frame on the IMAX and he'll go real loud with the mix. It's his way of turning it up to 11, both with the audio and the visual.
Yeah, and I just don't like it.
Yeah, and the thing about it, now I'll get into the actual critique of this whole IMAX thing, where he says IMAX is better than digital and this and that. And this intercutting of the aspect ratios thing. I had thought it was going to, first of all, did they do that in the digital version at all? Did you see jumping aspect ratios?
No. And I was looking for it based on your previous tweet from before I went to see the movie, when you were talking with Brian Hamilton, listener Brian.
Right. Okay. And that was my assumption of what they would do. And I knew that this was going to be a thing because he's done it before and I've read about it before. I've never actually seen it happen before. And I thought it was going to be less noticeable because you're generally looking at the center of the screen and you're enjoying whatever it is that you see. And they're not going to put, if they're smart, they're not going to put interesting information at the very top, at the very bottom of the screen, because not everyone can see that stuff. It's more to fill your view and give you a sense of awe. But it was incredibly noticeable when they would cut for a number of reasons. And I kept looking and going, oh, well, now we're in IMAX. And when it would jump to a big frame, I would start looking around because it was like, okay, this is a prettier image because it's got more resolution. It's a bigger frame. I would look around a little bit and I would enjoy that. And then as soon as it would cut back to the 35 millimeter stuff, I would notice that it looked like shit, particularly because the film grain was gigantic in the 35 millimeter blow up stuff. The 70 millimeter stuff actually looked really good, partly because the 70 millimeter stuff was mostly outside and it's easier to get a good exposure when you've got the giant sun for your film. But the contrast between these two, he's drawing attention to film's weaknesses. He's not just showing us a better film image. He's drawing attention to the weaknesses of film.
Okay.
So
I was just going to say, this is something where I think it really contrasts with the 4K digital projection experience, because I noticed almost no grain. I don't know if they did any cleanup at all on the digital intermediary that they distribute to their digital projectors or not, but I noticed almost none of it, or if it was just because it was played on a much smaller screen. But there was no aspect ratio change. I did not know from looking at it when they would cut, like which things were IMAX and which things were 35, when they're played in the same aspect ratio at the same size, it doesn't feel very different. Now I could tell with some things like lens flares, and we can talk about that later. Some of the, a little squishing and stuff like that, but he didn't use like noticeably defective anamorphic lenses or something where there was like big color shifts from chromatic aberration. I didn't notice any of that, at least on the normal theater experience. So I didn't find any jarring cuts in there. I did notice that when he does his ponderous long shot of nothing happening, when he does those, I always think in my mind that maybe this would look more impressive on IMAX. So this is probably one of the ones that was shot on IMAX, all these ponderous vistas. But the it never felt like any one thing was shot in one format or the other.
Yeah, it's generally the outdoor wides, you know, kind of the cornfields and the Matt Damon's planet, and I think the water planet and stuff. When they would first set down and the outdoor establishing shots, most of those were the IMAX ones. And you know, okay, so there's three formats that we need to discuss in this. There's IMAX, there's 35 millimeter anamorphic, and there's VistaVision, which is also 35 millimeter anamorphic, but it's horizontal instead of vertical, so you get a larger substrate out of it. But my assumption was at least some of these decisions were motivated by the locations. So inside the truck when he's driving around with his kids, inside the house from time to time, they need smaller rigs, and they're using what looks to me to be 35 millimeter, because there was a ton of film grain. The 70 millimeter stuff, the IMAX stuff, had the least amount of grain, and it looked real nice, especially up on the IMAX screen. All of it, I should say, looked dark compared to what I'm used to, which is the kind of the selling point of 4K. It's a lot brighter. That's also the flicker and all that, blah, blah, blah. We won't get into that. But the 35 millimeter stuff in particular, not only did it look extra dark, but it looked grainy to the point where I could feel the pain of the colorist, like pushing it in post, going, oh my God, it's starting to fall apart, but you still can't see anything. And it's just, it's dark.
I didn't have that experience at all when I was watching the 4K digital projection. I don't know if that is a difference in the projection technology, because I know that digital is much brighter than film projection is, even yeah. with IMAX film projection. But I couldn't tell you to be with any degree of certainty, whether yeah. or not that was really the case. But nothing felt dark or dingy or weird like that.
Well, based on your description of not seeing film grain, I kind of want to go see it again digitally projected now, because the film grain was honestly distracting in parts when it was 35. I could tell it was a blow up, and I don't know how much of that to attribute to the projection, because I mean, apparently it's some, because if you say you didn't see it, then you didn't see it. But I absolutely saw it. And I kind of knew a little bit going in, because Mike Seymour of FX Guide, he had a tweet saying something about he was bothered by the film grain as well. And they did a VFX show episode where they talked about some of the effects of it. But he said he was also distracted looking at the effects, trying to critique the work. But he was unconsciously concerned that it looked off for some reason, until he realized, oh, it's because it's film and I'm used to looking at it in pristine digital. But there are so many moving pieces to this, and anyone who knows anything about like the actual film printing process would know that there's so much generation loss and potential for issue there that it's not surprising. But I did not. This whole experiment of Christopher Nolan saying, I want to use the highest quality material for making my films, I'm on board with that. I think if you can use IMAX for an entire film, do it. This intercutting with 35 and projecting it in 70 millimeter film in an IMAX theater, I do not enjoy. So maybe there is something to be said about the same reason we shoot 5K, 6K and scale down to 4K or HD, where you have that higher quality that's being scaled down for a smaller format. That's a legitimate thing to do. Maybe there's something to be said about shooting in 70 millimeter or IMAX, I should say, and presenting digitally or in a different format. But this whole presenting in IMAX, mixing the two and jumping around with aspect ratios, I don't enjoy.
I agree with you in theory. That would make me crazy. Now it can work. Changing aspect ratios to, you know, just to be clear, can work as a narrative device. If it is not there for a narrative device, like, you know, at the beginning of Galaxy Quest, we go from a 4:3 TV aspect ratio as a standard definition TV aspect ratio, up to, what was it? 1.65 or eventually they get to 2.35. So they're changing aspect ratio, but it's based on the media that's being shown.
Right. And I should say Grand Budapest, we talked about this a little bit, I think probably offline. I really enjoyed the way they did that in Grand Budapest Hotel, where he uses pretty much every aspect ratio he could find for a narrative purpose. And I rather enjoyed that.
I haven't seen it yet because he makes me crazy.
well, you saw Interstellar and you don't really like Christopher Nolan, so go for it.
You made me do it because we had to do it for the podcast.
I made you do it.
Yes, you twisted my arm. But this movie, back to this movie, I think you might get something more out of seeing the 4K digital projection version, but then that does raise the point of what's the point in watching it in IMAX or watching it in 4K or watching it at home if it's going to be a totally different viewing experience, if the crazy aspect ratio shifting and grain and stuff is the top shelf experience that someone wants you to have.
Well, I think what I'm saying is the top shelf experience should be IMAX all the way. He should not compromise with the smaller 35 millimeter stuff if he can handle it. And, you know, for $160 million production, I mean, I'm sure there are multiple reasons why he's mixing 35 and IMAX. I just don't think that restraint makes any sense. I don't know. I should probably do some more research as to why they're mixing formats at this point. If IMAX is the pinnacle and that's how you want to show it to people, shoot it all IMAX, because that experience is fantastic. I do enjoy seeing the full frame 144:1 aspect ratio image, but the intercutting with 35 kind of ruins it, because I'm noticing the jumps, the 2.2 stuff, 30 from the 35 millimeter, it looks bad comparatively. And I don't like seeing, what was the Natural Born Killers, where they intentionally jump between a bunch of different garbage cameras and normal cameras. That was for an effect. This is not doing that. And this is distracting for unintentionally. And I don't enjoy that particular part. Okay. But I think we've probably spent entirely too much time talking about the technical aspects of this.
I was trying to pull you back from this 70 millimeter ledge,
but that is a thing about this movie, that is a selling point, that is a thing that Christopher Nolan believes in, and now having seen it first person, I don't understand it. I gotta say, I mean, I agree with him that 70 millimeter is great. I still think there are equally as stunning images in 6K, and as long as you don't screw up the projection to make it look like a television with 120 hertz frame or whatever, that sort of that feeling you get from watching digital projection, I don't see a reason to do this and waste your time and effort in film.
Okay, horse is dead. Moving on.
Yes.
So what is going on in this movie? We briefly discussed the opening, but there is a component to the opening, which is the poltergeist. And the sort of like child fibbing about something moving, possibly in the story there, as well as all of the stuff about the actual world. I didn't like the children. I mean, it's not an unusual statement for me
to
make.
Well, you don't like children in general, so.
Yeah, I know. They got to work really hard in order for me to not hate them. And unfortunately, they worked hard enough that I didn't hate them, but I wasn't a super huge fan of Murph or the other, I don't know, the idiot that goes on to be Casey Affleck. what was his name? Tom? Todd? I don't know. Person.
I've already forgotten.
Yeah, because he's such a nothing character. It's one of the big complaints I have about this movie is there right from the get-go. I don't care about his family. The only relationship that matters is him and his daughter. Which is not the whole family, which is a shame because John Lithgow is great. He does a very good job. I don't believe that any of these people are related, but he turns in a fantastic performance.
Well, John Lithgow is supposed to be a stepdad, I think.
No, his father-in-law.
Right. That's what I said. Yes, father-in-law.
Yeah, but none of the kids look like they're from that side of the family or the other side of the family. Like, maybe they look like their mom, but I don't know how both Casey Affleck and Jessica Chastain look like the mom, but whatever. That's not important. And it was just one of those things where it's just like, the casting's a little strange, and the accents and stuff, and Matthew McConaughey is just orange through this whole movie.
he is rather orange, isn't he?
Yeah, I don't understand. With the color grading that we have now?
I know, he's a farmer, so he probably spends a lot of time outdoors, and that's just his tan. That's how he tans.
No one in this movie is this color. This is not a natural color. He's orange, he looks like an orange catcher's mitt.
This movie does succumb to the teal and orange color grading of kind of stereotype these days.
Yeah. And then, you know, one of the things I do like from this opening, aside from setting up the blight, which I think is done well enough. We aren't like pounded with exposition. Like I said, good stuff. The other thing I like is that we get a sense of how this shapes priorities in the world when we have the parent-teacher meeting at the school. And we are introduced to an environment where achievement is not sought after. Everyone needs to set their expectations and the bar for themselves to be lower. And this is something that Matthew McConaughey chafes at and rebuffs, enough to the point where he gets his daughter suspended. But it's a really, I really like that scene. I don't like the metaphors that Matthew McConaughey uses. I don't like any of the metaphors he ever uses, but especially much later in the movie when he talks about yachts, and it's like, who is racing yachts in the Dust Bowl? I don't understand what's going on here.
Well, for being a character, particularly in that parent-teacher conference, yeah, where he's on the cusp of the two generations, the one who sort of survived in a regular world and the one who is in this new reprioritized world, mm-hmm, he does kind of fit that character where he can talk out of line and he can be the rebel that pushes things along. But yeah, I don't think he lived in a time where he knew a whole lot of people that were cruising around on yachts. Maybe it's just because he's a generally curious human being and education is paramount for him. And that's just something he happened to learn somewhere along the line.
Yeah, but it still makes his metaphors unrelatable to the people of the world he lives in. But whatever, it's beside the point. But I like that conference that they have. Yeah. I thought that
the underlying premise for the film, this dust bowl of a world with the blight and the reprioritized human existence, is, I think, believable enough and well built enough to for everything else in the movie to stand on top of and build from there. So I enjoy that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And I also like the fact that you set up that there's no war anymore because there's no point to it.
Right.
Like things have gotten so bad in the world that no one is fighting anymore, which is brought up several times with the drone and again with some characters we'll meet later on. But after this whole thing, there's that huge dust storm, and I don't know why he's driving. He's just pulled the car over. After that dust storm, they go to the house, and she goes upstairs to close the window, and then we see the pattern from the dust falling a certain way. And that is what sets everything in motion for the film. Because it's no longer the crazy poltergeist story. It is actually something unusual is occurring. And curiously, it's a binary thing. I don't know how he figures this out, but he does. At first he's like, no, it's not Morse code, because that would be silly. And then he's like, oh, it's binary. And it's like, that's normal. And it's a
well,
location.
I should say, when I was really bored in college, I used to write sentences in binary in my notebook to take up as much time as possible.
I was never that bored. And so
clearly you didn't take the history of radio and film.
God. But anyway, so they go drive over to the base, and it has really poor visibility and security or whatever. I don't know. It seems like there should actually be a guard there other than just leaving all the lights off and hoping nobody notices that you have a secret installation there.
Well, there was a guard there. There was a robot.
Yeah, but a guard post, like an actual human being to be like, hey, person, rather than just knocking out anybody that shows up at your door.
Well, it was a bit of like a commune, wasn't it? It was kind of an underground, everyone lives here and we don't go outside or people will find out about us kind of thing.
Yeah, well, and see, this is another thing. I don't understand the point of the station. Like, they have a whole support staff for, setting up that whole thing, and they couldn't find Matthew McConaughey when they needed a pilot.
Well, it did seem that way, and he does kind of double back on the plot a couple times for the purposes of confusion, I think. But the whole reveal that he didn't actually have to go because there was no intention of coming back, spoilers, mm-hmm, I think that was indicative of the fact that they weren't really looking for him. These people were in the simulator, but they didn't really feel that they needed him. They were basically just going to fire these people out through the black hole and let them do their thing because that's their mission at this point.
Yeah, and then Michael Caine's like, why not just add another body to the fire or something?
If you can get a better pilot to join along, why the hell not? And he was clearly selfish and misguided. But
I'm Michael Caine, and for some reason, Anne Hathaway is my daughter.
Yeah, there is a little bit of Christopher Nolan playing favorites, as a lot of these big directors do with his former cast members. But I think for the most part, people played their roles well.
Yeah, no. I will say this. Anne Hathaway is supposed to be a professor. I don't know what she's a professor of. She basically just monitors the embryos and says that she's an expert on planets for life reasons later on. And I never got a sense of her competency in the film until the last like 5 seconds where she set up a camp by herself. But I'm assuming the robot did most of that.
Well, this is where my general skepticism of academia kicks in, because if you were to put a quote unquote doctor in a situation like that, I think they would be able to handle themselves well if they had a long enough time to think about it and weigh all their options. But in the crisis situation where Anne Hathaway falls apart on the water planet, I could totally see somebody who has no field experience doing exactly that and kind of screwing everything up.
Yes, no, and I'm not disputing the fact that her falling apart makes sense for her character. I'm disputing the fact that she never seems like she's actually good at anything in this film.
Which well, there's nothing to say you have to be good at something to have a doctorate.
I guess, but that just seems really depressing given the high standards of education these days.
Well, I mean, the Earth is not in as good shape as it was, so you take what you can get.
Yeah, but you're only letting in like 2% of the population into higher education.
And, well, I mean, plus her dad owns the spaceship, so she gets
nepotism?
Free ride. Yeah, probably a little bit.
Anyway.
I mean, she was at least there for the whole plan. It's not like they can put out a Craigslist ad saying, hey, guys, we're going to go repopulate the human race in a different galaxy and let everyone else here die. So sign up if you're the best.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say, it's interesting also in terms of casting for the other NASA guys. I don't know what they were thinking. Because
with who in particular?
What was his name? Romilly. He seems drunk or high. In almost all of his scenes, but maybe that's just a side effect of the Dramamine. But he doesn't seem like he's got it all together either. And then there's Doyle, who I thought, honest to God, was going to like be an actual like foil for the character until his untimely death. So I applaud them for that, because that wasn't predictable. And then the other casting choice for like the for Topher Grace.
He came out of nowhere, didn't he?
Yeah, that like we're what, 2/3 of the way through the film, and it's like, here's her love interest, Topher Grace. Applaud. I don't understand where that really came
from. I mean,
if you're
Christopher Nolan, you're probably allowed to stack pretty much every role with A-listers, but that's fine. Or whatever list Topher Grace
really,
is on.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you're really gonna put him on your A-list? Like if you had to pick him for a race, let's say, would you pick Topher Grace? I would not.
The thing about Romilly, I thought it was interesting. The whole screw up down on the water planet, how that left him stranded for 23 something odd years. I can only imagine what that would do to somebody's psyche, and the fact that it kind of broke him, I thought was interesting. But he did seem a little bit out there for a while.
Mm-hmm. Now, I will say that my favorite characters in the entire film are Tars and Case.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. I love the robots.
They are pretty fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And what I really like about them is that they don't howl anything up. They don't, you know, play to any particular trope where they're trying to like defeat humanity at any point. So good. I like that. I like good robots.
What did you think of the design of the robots?
I thought that was ludicrous. I'm being serious. I don't understand. Like, the production design for everything else in the movie and the world, total sense. Everything makes total sense. Looks like it all functions. It has parts and pieces that make sense and is built off of technology we have today.
Except for the cylindrical space station at the end.
Yeah. Well,
but that's just...
That's because they defeated gravity and lifted the whole thing off the planet and
it's
made out of cement.
That's because Christopher Nolan put a lot of time and effort into the development of whatever they used to bend Paris in Inception. and he just really likes that look. But do you think, I mean, there are certainly a lot of people calling references all over the place to 2001. Do you think it was just a monolith reference that they took as far as they could?
I have to assume that is a component of it. Because this movie does not parody or pay homage to 2001 in any explicit way.
No.
And I applaud Nolan for having the good sense not to do that. Now, the design of the robots, yes, it could be a monolith reference, but whatever it is, whatever the rationale is, the resulting design is just weird. It doesn't seem to be practical. They have components that sort of fold up in and out and around and stuff, depending on all kinds of weird situations. They can run really fast, and they can also turn into like a little asterisk that spins like a wheel. Like it doesn't, and what they do and how they function, I don't understand. Their personalities I really like. And so them as characters, I enjoy. Them as prop, I do not.
Yeah, I thought for the first two thirds of the movie, probably right up until the asterisk scene, I thought they were also ludicrous, especially when it's like laying as a control surface in the middle of the spaceship. It's like, well, you're just kind of sleeping on the floor because there's no room for you here. But when they revealed themselves to be more versatile and unfold and to move quickly and to have those sort of hands that unfolded. And apparently there was in the design of them in 3D, there was another level of minute detail that would unfold from the arms that we even saw that was just not used, but built. I gave him more credit at that point, but for the first two thirds of the movie, I just kept saying like, this is absurd. There's gotta be other ways you can build functional, strong robots. But towards the end of the movie, I was more on board with their functionality rather than just this sort of seesawing, lumbering thing, because it didn't seem to have a whole lot of dexterity.
I think it was scissoring.
I am absolutely not. It didn't seem to have a whole lot of dexterity when we first saw it attack Matthew McConaughey and sort of like threaten him in that interrogation room. It was just kind of like chest bumping him and sort of like lumbering around the room.
Yeah. They do demonstrate more dexterity later on in the film. I wonder how much of that is from shooting with the practical puppety ones, and being like, man, this is kind of a dull, and deciding to stage some other more exciting things later on. But the CG looked terrible for them. I think that a lot of the effects in this movie are good, but swapping back and forth from those practical ones to the computer-generated ones, they just look so phony.
See, I genuinely didn't notice, and this is probably, getting back to the film and digital thing, this is probably what that was, because I thought they integrated surprisingly well for being CG.
Maybe it's just me, but the CG ones just were, like, lifted and, like, sort of ambiently shiny in a very strange way.
I believe that's what it looked like. I don't... I mean, because we certainly... there's no excuse for any animation issues, because it's a hard body that has a limited range of motion. So there's really no way they should be able to get that wrong in animation. I mean, there's not a whole lot you could do wrong in animation to make it look fake. But the rendering itself, I would like to see it in digital, because on film it certainly looked fine to me. Well, there was a little bit of issue in the asterisk scene with the interaction with the water, but that's just the nature of it.
Yeah, well, especially with the running, which happens later. Because the running's terrible. Because we don't see the puppet ever move with that level of speed, because of course not, it's a puppet. Like there's that scene before they leave the NASA station where it's following along behind them and it's the puppet. We just can't see the base of it. And so they're just like moving the blocks back and forth practically on set. And it's just slightly out of focus in the back, and it can't keep up with the actors, so they pan over. but in space on the water planet, where gravity is even heavier than it is on Earth, it's just like, whoa, I'm gonna, you know, go crazy. And I don't know why he ran faster after having picked her up than he was moving when he turned into the asterisk, and because that was slow. It didn't make any sense. But that's really more of a production issue than anything else.
Did you see any of the behind-the-scenes photos of the puppet rig?
No.
It's kind of just like a bodysuit. There was a human standing directly behind it and just kind of like kicking the legs out with his legs and arms and just operating. It was a single person.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds about right. Because that's what it looked like. Because they had some scenes where it would pivot to like follow an eye line or something as Matthew McConaughey walks past. And it was not good because it wasn't moving to pivot. It was pivoting like it was rotating. It wasn't like taking a step to turn. So that was another thing that bugged me a couple times. But I'm nitpicking because I honestly like them. As characters, I enjoy them.
Robots aside, what do you think of? Let's get a little sciencey. What do you think of the science principles put forth in this film? Both the black hole, the planets that they go to, that sort of stuff.
I think it makes as much sense as I was expecting from Christopher Nolan. like my critical analysis of it as, of course, a quadruple PhD in quantum mechanics and stuff is that it was a little silly. But mainly for strategic reasons, I think it was silly. Because if you're aliens that can bend space and time, why did you put the wormhole so far away?
It's not aliens, remember?
Well, it could be them in the future, maybe.
Yeah, well, that's
it's ambiguous.
It's not really ambiguous at that point. We pretty much think he determined it. But
well, you know, but he speculates still. He says they are us, and you know they're just more advanced than we are. But which is fine. We don't conclusively ever learn that. But it is implied that it could potentially be either future humans or just another advanced civilization. Either way. But they of course do determine that it was Matthew McConaughey causing the communication to occur, directed through this Byzantine method of communication, which also doesn't make any sense, because they had a hard time interacting with three-dimensional humans, from their five-dimensional space. But that's why it doesn't make any sense. Like things like putting, if the aliens knew they needed her, so they somehow set up this paradox to get him to actually be the one that sends the messages, then it doesn't make a lot of sense that they made it so hard to do that. Because it was sitting there for 48 years, this wormhole out by Saturn. If it was actually about helping humanity, it seems like they missed the target a little bit.
Well, it's the time is relative, clearly, because there is no time. Okay, so I want to try and it's hard to talk about this because there are things I like about it, but at the same time, I'm going to tear it to shreds just because I can't help myself. I like the fact that Christopher Nolan is willing to go on a limb and kind of destroy things along with his as he's telling a story. So this idea that he's trying desperately to get back to his daughter, and that's the most important thing. I like that he barely gets a chance to get back to her at the very end. And well, there could have been a little bit more interaction between him and his daughter when she was on her deathbed there. But I like that he was willing to let it go and make the stakes high enough to not just kill off a red shirt character on the water planet, but to actually make the ultimate goal kind of a failure. He barely gets back to his daughter. He left his daughter alone for what, like 90 years or something? That's terrible. And I like that Christopher Nolan is willing to go there. But for certain things like this time dilation thing on the water planet, where they know it's 7 years per hour, they know that before they go down there because they're prepared for it. And they want to say, we got to get there as fast as possible. These are PhDs, these are science people, they know what they're doing. They should be able to do that math ahead of time to realize how long the beacon has been going. So that thing that Anne Hathaway says while they're down there on the planet, yeah, super sad, like she's probably only been here for minutes and the signal's been going for years to us. You should have known that before you got there. For the love of God, why did you go there like that now?
No, and this is another thing that really bugs me about this. The communication is incredibly inconsistent and seems dependent purely on where he wants to direct the characters in the picture. Because at certain times, people can send things, and at certain times, people can receive things. And it is not always consistently clear when that is possible. For instance, they had Data come back from the wormhole to know that these people had landed and that there was data on the planets. And so that information was going through. So they had that to go off of. They send the ship through, and then there's more information that was cached at the beacon that was orbiting the wormhole on that side than there was on the Earth, than there was on the Saturn side. So then they have additional information that they're pulling in. And then someone's like, oh yeah, Matthew McConaughey, there's a black hole in the solar system nobody talked about before. And they have that explanation. And then that is somehow related to why they can't send any signals now back to Earth, but they can receive them. And then that also gets further complicated by the fact that they can't talk to the scientists that are on planets or do anything useful, like say, hey, computer on the planet, wake up the scientist that's there. They can only get the passive information from them. And so that's how they determine that one planet, Edmund, I believe, that he's dead, but that the data on the planet seems good. Or he at least can't communicate. And then they have what's-her-face on the water planet, and they think that hers is the best shot. And like you're saying, it's in time dilation crap hole. And then there's the third planet, which was Dr. Mann's planet, and has promising information, and it seems like he's alive. and so those are our three options that we're given out of the 12 people that went through. These are the three best ones, and they're all orbiting in some way a black hole that no one mentions until they get through. And none of the information that bounces around is consistently relayed. Like, they don't send a message to the main ship from their little ship that they use to land on the planet. When they get back up there, and the guy is like, oh, I thought you guys were dead. And it's like, literally, a radio message is going to travel faster than your ship. You should have just phoned him and said, hey, we're probably not dead, but this other guy who was with us is dead. So even though there's time dilation, he still would have had like a 5-minute heads up. I don't understand why they didn't even do that. It was just like a surprise when they opened the airlock, and it's just like, ah, I'm just here in my bathrobe. What's up, guys? I thought you were all dead.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things. There's a minor point that they made on the VFX show, the FX Guide show, which I didn't really realize when I was watching the movie, but they're totally correct. When they take off from Earth, they show the standard rocket separation that we're used to with all of the boosters that's required to get to space. When they leave the water planet with stronger gravity than Earth, they just take their little cruiser ship, and somehow that's enough to escape the gravity.
Oh. Don't get me started on these cruiser ships and their like miraculous hovering capabilities.
Well, that's a minor point to the one that is sticking with me long after I've seen the movie. So when he ends up in the black hole at the end of the movie, this is kind of the crux of the whole thing. He's losing his mind trying to communicate with Murph because he thinks he's screwed. He's never going to get back. He wants himself to stay in the past. So he sends his Morse code message of stay. But then he does the dumbest thing he could possibly do. If his goal is to get him to not leave the planet, don't send yourself binary address of NASA. Like, why would he do that? He knows that's how he got to NASA. Why would he send himself away? All he had to do was not do that, and then he's not leaving because they don't go there.
But see, his goals are split. Right. And this is a problem with the film. His goals are split. There is the struggle to be with your family, and there is the struggle to save the human race.
Yeah, I think he made that turn a little too quickly.
Yeah, he ping-pongs back and forth between these things throughout most of the film, and this is supposed to be the tension that we feel there at the end. And he's emotional about seeing his daughter, but not being able to interact with her, and finding out he's really the ghost that causes the whole thing. But then finding out that because he's the ghost that causes the whole thing, then he can also fix this by giving them the information from the black hole so that theoretically they could solve all of the problems that they are having. I mean, okay.
But it's like if he's testing his abilities to communicate back in time by doing the binary NASA thing, like, why doesn't he have a test that isn't quite so life-altering? Like, if he's got to do something to see if he can interact with the past so he can then go on to do the thing with the watch hand, maybe do something other than the whole NASA coordinate.
No, anyway. But that wasn't a test, though. By that point, he knew that was him.
Well, it was the first thing he had done. So I gave him that, like, all right, you're going to try and see if you can send gravity back in time, because that's the disembodied voice of TARS, wherever it is telling you that you can send gravity back and forth. So that's how you're going to communicate. But I don't know. I just the way he went from all I want to do is convince me not to leave to I'm going to send all of this data back to my daughter. And then there was a lot of glossing over the, you know, they used the line from TARS to say, well, she's not going to get it for a very long time if you do your little watch thing there, which I thought the science or whatever, the little room he's in there, I thought that was fine enough. But the whole, you know, they have to say it like, well, she's not going to get it for a long time. And then there was that sort of fake built up tension of they got to do it before Casey Affleck gets back because he's going to be super mad, which was like, in the grand scheme of things, your brother gets pissed off at you. But like, OK, your dad who left for space how many decades ago is somehow communicating, maybe put your on the back burner for a little while.
Well, you kind of jumped around a bit there because we were talking about communication, but yep. But just to address something,
it's all intermixed though, and that's the thing, the communication intermixed with these character moments, like Anne Hathaway's character moment where she's talking about how love is sending her to go see Edmund because it's,
oh my God,
that was a moment that, like, even if there was a rational point in there, her slow push in like long speech there was just way, way too much. And I don't need, it was a great acting moment for capital A actors for her to just let her cry and go, you know, go let her go to 11 with the emotion while she's trying to get a part of the story out. But it was like, I don't need that. And there were a couple of those moments where it was just like, let's get past this and get back to the actual movie.
Okay. You brought up something that really bugs the crap out of me. Her whole love monologue drove me bananas. Like my head was in my hand, like face palming when this was going on. Cause it's not a short little thing. It's not like some little thing she mentions.
No, not at all.
She goes on and on, and she's got this whole theory about this. And it's just like, why is this in the movie at all? And it doesn't come back up again, other than Matthew McConaughey, something like, oh, love is what's going to connect us through time.
Well, it's there so he can scoff at it and then kind of come back to like a halfway realization later that my love for my daughter is what motivated me to send her all this data, in, you know, to save the human race instead of just like give up in the black hole or whatever.
But it's not love. That's the thing that drives
no,
me.
No, it's not.
It's gravity. It is science. And see, that's okay. Well, it's the science in this movie, quote unquote. And that's one of those things that bugs me about this movie, because in one of the opening scenes, we get the whole spiel about how ghosts and poltergeists and stuff aren't real. They're not scientific, and that you need to like have a scientific mind about this stuff. And then at the end of the movie, he's all like, love, man, I'm going to communicate with my daughter and the Tesseract thing. And it's just like, I really wish you wouldn't conflate these things. Like, it is not love there. And Matthew McConaughey's character should know better than that. His feelings might tie him closely to his daughter, but that's just memories that are tying him to his daughter. His memories are not love incarnate as like another force in the universe. Like, that's not actually causing anything to happen. It annoys me because I feel like it's cheap. It's tawdry. I don't approve of love. So let's move past that.
And then, you know, if I try to look at it objectively and try and see it from the other side and see like, why is this the choice that's being made? And the only thing I can think is that when you're talking about a movie of this scale and this magnitude with the things that they're actually doing with science, with action, with all those things, if you didn't turn the emotion up on every character to match that equally, it would feel disjointed and disconnected, because he's built this whole world where you know, they say in a movie is success. The reason movies are successful and sequels are not so much is because a movie is supposed to be like the most interesting thing that has ever happened to a particular character. It seems like every single character in this movie is having the most emotional time of their entire life every second through this movie. And it's almost exhausting to the point that it's like they turned up the color saturation too high, but it's the emotion. It's just it permeates every second of this. And I get that there are dire moments when they're down there on the water planet. I would be losing my mind too if I knew that every hour 7 years were going by, especially, you know, the scene when he gets back and he watches the video from his kids and he starts breaking down crying. I was right there with him. There were a couple emotional moments that actually got to me, that they were seriously emotional. And that kind of stuff worked because you saw the ramifications in his personal life of this mission that he had to embark on, and the things, the screw ups had real effect on him. But there are other moments where you could sort of dial that down a little bit. Yes, I know you're in space. Yes, I know you're going to sacrifice yourself into a black hole for the fate of humanity, but then you're going to ping pong the other direction to try and save yourself. But then you're going to ping pong back to try and save humanity again by transmitting data. It's like, it's all over the place. And the only consistency I can find is that everything is turned all the way up all the time.
Okay. I'm not as hard on many of the emotional scenes. I am hard on those scenes that are not as effective, in that I don't feel anything when they have their emotions cranked up.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah, when it's done in places that don't necessarily suit it. Like when he's ping-ponging back and forth in the Tesseract there, I wasn't on board. When he's crying looking at how many years he's missed with his kids and how his father-in-law is dead and all of this stuff, like that stuff worked. It got to me.
Yeah. No, see, and that's, I agree with you. There are emotionally effective moments in this film. They are just also intermixed with a lot of emotionally unaffecting material. They are both treated with the same gravitas by the filmmaker in his inability to edit down anything. So that is why we get the clunky love speech from Anne Hathaway, and why we get weird... prolonged, exaggerated black hole Tesseract scene. I just thought that went on too long. Like, I had it figured out before he did, that he was the one who sent the messages, way before him, and then also way before his daughter, who is supposed to be a smart cookie, but she was not getting it. So those things weren't emotionally effective because I was ahead of the characters and I didn't feel any of the struggle that they were like. I was like, just get to it, like get to that point, like move past that. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's 3 hours long and he didn't edit any of this stuff appropriately. Like, there's no, the scenes with her taking care of, with Jessica Chastain taking care of the sick doctor on Earth, too long. Not incredibly important. The revelation that the doctor gives to her on his deathbed is important, but a total curveball because it doesn't really seem to relate to anything. And if you took it out of the film, I think it would be the same.
Well, it does sort of... It sort of takes away her hope that Matthew McConaughey is coming back on his own and sort of puts her in the driver's seat saying, no, you're going to have to figure this out some other way because he's been lying to you. And I know they've been trying to solve the equation that turned out to be bogus, but I think it kind of breaks her out of her just blind hope that suddenly he'd be back and sort of kind of makes her have to realize that she's going to have to solve something. And since this whole time doesn't exist thing, maybe that watch has been sitting there this whole time, and now she realizes she's got to dig deeper and figure out what to do and get back to, she has to go find the answer herself. So that kind of pushes her in that direction. I get what you're saying. I'm trying to remember now, though. There were a couple moments that felt completely glossed over, like there was a missing 20 or so minutes of the actual film, and I'm struggling to remember what they were now, because now you got me thinking about the self-indulgent moments.
Yeah, well, that's all I can think about, really.
The particular one that I meant was the, I mentioned it briefly earlier, is when he actually does get to see his daughter again for the first time in like 90 years or whatever it was. I thought that scene was just like, well, we did it. You can leave now because I'm going to die and go hook up with Anne Hathaway. Like that scene, like maybe hang out for a couple days. Like,
yeah, no, I am 100% on board with you. When I was sitting there in the theater and it was unfolding, I was like, are you are you kidding? Like, of course you're going to stay there with your daughter. Even if she tells you to leave, you stay. And yeah. He's just like, nope, I'm out the door. I get for a certain
perspective that, like, their interaction and their, like, transmitting of the data and the solving of the problem happened, like, 60 years ago for her. But maybe just hang out, man. Like, where else are you going to be? Like, how is Anne Hathaway suddenly more important, particularly because zero time is passing between the two of you now since there's no ridiculous time dilation?
Yeah, and see, this is okay. This bugs me too, because there's time dilation that has occurred between Matthew McConaughey when he arrives back after the Tesseract, when they seem to have shoved him through the wormhole back into Saturn's orbit, and the station's there and stuff like that. So time has moved, but then cutting to Anne Hathaway setting up her camp. Looks like no time has passed other than maybe like a week.
Well, did you get that one line when they were flying into the black hole and one of them shouted out, we're going to lose 40 years for this, just because they were using the black hole to slingshot her towards the regular planet and him going in.
I missed that because of the sound mixing.
One of them shouted out, I hope this works because we're going to lose 40 years for it. Now, the fact that once they split and she goes flying off to the regular planet, time dilation stops for her. He goes into the black hole where presumably time dilation stops for him too. I would have thought it would have accelerated further, but I am not a physicist, so what do I know? Apparently just that slingshotting around the black hole is what advanced them yet another 40 years, and now that's why his daughter is 90 or whatever, and he is 125.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. So that was just a little confusing and weird, and it was very rushed at the end. So while I say that I wish he had edited this movie more, I'm talking about other things. I'm not talking about the part at the end where he's just like, here's a bunch of random that happened at the end. Everybody's lives happily ever after. Ta-da!
But getting back to Christopher Nolan's style a little bit, I think as potentially ancillary as some of those scenes were, he does build a pretty robust world and story that kind of... I don't want to say it helps gloss over the issues with the plot, but... It basically adds character, and it adds basically what feels like human error to a potentially sterile story. And yeah, there's a lot of crush that comes along with it, but there was some interesting stuff in the sense that we got all of these moving pieces. We got the Michael Caine piece where he lied about this because, you know, there was only one hope. We got these scientists who could have just been just as disposable as Hunger Games boy down on the water planet. But, you know, Matt Damon's character actually threw yet another wrench into the story. And there was a lot of subversion of what you thought could potentially happen. And there was a lot of, I don't know, I didn't fully expect what actually happened in every instance of the movie, which I thought was interesting. I thought it was well done to a certain extent. It felt cinematic. It felt unexpected in a lot of places. And like I said from the beginning, I'm glad that he's willing to like take these chances and say it's not going to be the super happiest of endings. Like, we don't know that the human race is going to survive after all this. We know a large portion of them are living on a space station. We know that they got a lot of data out of that black hole. He got to see his daughter again briefly before she died. But like all of this stuff, it's not like, hooray, we defeated the enemy and life is great now. It's just like, well, you accomplished your mission to the best of your abilities, even though there were a great many casualties. But it was kind of a moral victory more than it was an actual victory. And I guess that's kind of getting back to the emotional part of it.
No, I will push back a little here because it is actually a victory because we leave the movie with hope where there was no hope at the beginning of this film.
Well, okay, that's what I mean by moral victory. It's not like hope is not going to save the human race. Hope is a good thing to have, but they haven't solved their problem with the Earth dying and a new planet being needed.
Well... But they never were going to solve the problem with that. They were just going to go to another planet, and which is what they're doing at the end of it. And
they're not there yet, is all I'm saying. It's just that they haven't solved all the problems.
Yeah, I'm sure they all die off screen like 2 seconds later. But see,
it's just like Contact, and Jake Busey runs in and blows up the space station.
Oh goodness! No, what a mess of them. Okay, I have strong feelings on space movies. And so they go through, theoretically, and they start their new world or whatever. That'll be all great and stuff. But But that all felt like it happened too quickly at the end, where they set up everything after he got out of his space coma. I think that it just needed to breathe more there, while everything before it breathes way too much. And there is one thing that I really, one of my favorite parts of the movie is the ice planet. I that's because purely because of Matt Damon, as Dr. Mann. Now I liked that part of the movie, but everything that happened in it was telegraphed and predictable. Because it was very clear to me when they showed up at the ice planet that this was not going to actually be the planet. Even when they go and they thaw him out and he tells them how great it is to be around other human beings, the fact that we see a broken down marine robot there, huge red flag.
Well, he says he had to sacrifice him to take his battery to keep going. I kind of believe that.
No. It was something like he said that it started to degenerate, which is something that Matthew McConaughey had said earlier about the marine robots, is that they degenerate over time and they start to go a little crazy. Which if you are a fan of like Halo or something or anything by Bungie, there's a sort of like a machine dementia that occurs, which is sort of similar to what he's describing here. But it was very suspect to me that he was a good person on this ice planet with a broken robot. These facts were starting to add up that maybe he was, in fact, a little bananas. And
see, I bought the broken robot. I totally bought whatever excuse he had.
Oh, you idiot. You would die on the ice planet.
So no, what I would have done when he started headbutting me, I would not keep holding him to the ground and say, you're going to kill one of us. Mm-hmm. I would have jumped up and kicked him in the face.
Okay. That fight was ludicrous. Like it was just silly. I don't know why that unfolded the way it did. Like it was like they pause and they're like talking to each other. And it's just like, get the f*** out of there. What are you doing? Like, why are you having this little casual chit chat? Punch him in the face or something, or the groin. Do something.
But it's like he was trying to pin him down and hug him long enough to say, it's not your fault. Let's go back. It's going to be okay.
Yeah. Like, I mean, sure enough, you know, Matthew McConaughey is an engineer and a pilot and not a like killer, but at the same time, I feel like my survival instinct would at least be like, hey, maybe don't let him get within 5 feet of me again after he just pushed me down this cliff and tried to kick it in my fingers so that that I would fall.
And I also question that, since they basically stated that they're kind of on a rescue mission, all they wanted was the data and to take the scientists and get out of there, and then they'll figure out how to get the human race back there eventually. Like, what was the problem with Matt Damon just saying, yep, I lied. This is not the planet. Sorry, I'm a jerk. Can we leave now?
Okay, this is where that thing that I had objected to earlier with mentioning the fact that there was no real plan A, that it was only ever going to be plan B.
Right, because he does say he had prior knowledge that was the goal, right?
Right. And so he knew that he wanted them to come to their planet, to his planet, because otherwise they weren't going to come. And then he was going to save himself and then save the human race in a very selfish way. He was not thinking clearly at this point in his life. And there's the...
I don't know about that. If he's had all of these years to think about his plan, why wouldn't he just say, as soon as they show up, yes, I know we have to repopulate the human race. I'm sorry I lied to get you down here to save me. This is not the place. Let's go to Edmund's planet. All of us together.
I think he was still under this delusion that he was in the right. And this is where I'm saying he wasn't thinking clearly, is because he even goes on these big speeches about how it was necessary to do this, that he couldn't handle it, so he had to save himself, but it's necessary to save the human race with him in charge. And he has this self-importance that...
Which we get from the very beginning with Anne Hathaway saying he was the reason this whole thing kicked off, and she says he's the best of us or whatever, but that's probably just mostly speaking to his steadfast motivation to get off the planet and to go save the human race.
Yeah, well, I think that was mostly his sense of self-preservation.
So basically what we're saying is in this future where NASA's resources have been dwindled so drastically, they don't have the psychologists on staff to weed out a sociopath like Matt Damon.
Yeah, I mean, but he's bananas. And now some of that could be he lost part of his marbles from the many years he was on the planet by himself. Because this is after the time dilation and stuff, so it's even longer than when they first set out on the trip.
Yeah, we don't actually get a measurement of the time dilation for his planet, right? Because, well, I thought it was actually real time because his planet was far enough away from the black hole to not be affected by it. Well, that's why they went there instead of Edmonds.
Yeah, but it was real time, but this is after they were affected by time dilation. So the amount
that is a good point. So yeah. The 23 years that affected Romilly also affected Matt Damon.
Well, 23 years plus the 10, I think it was, from before they went through the hole. Because the astronauts that went out there on the first mission, the 12 astronauts on the Lazarus Project, they went out 10 years prior to the events of the film. And then the events of the film occur, and it takes 2 years to go to Saturn, and then it takes whatever additional amount of time it was, I can't remember the exact interval, for the time consumed by going to the water planet. And so all of that stuff adds up, and he's had that time to think by himself and run through all of his rations and set it a big sleep interval with no timed release. And one of the things I have to bring up here is that Matt Damon is effectively able to lie to them about the surface of the planet because they can only see the frozen clouds, and he has falsified data that he's been sending them to lure them to the planet. Also, on the water planet, no one does a flyover of the planet. I don't understand why you would just go to a planet, be like, hey, I'm going to go down to the surface. No big. I'll just land near this beacon thing. It'll be fine. Like, what could possibly go wrong? And it goes wrong several times, twice. You'd think after the first time where it was like, oh, there's a giant wave. It'd be the second time it's like, oh, there's a beacon on a frozen cloud. Maybe this is going to work out really well for us. No, just, and they have the landers going up and down. It's just like, just fly underneath the frozen cloud layer cover and see what is going on this planet. And they don't do it. I don't understand that at all. They take his story at face value, but weirdly enough, TARS suspects something because he disabled the autopilot on the ship. I don't know what tipped him off. I mean, he must have been picking up on the same warning signals I got, but he didn't mention it to anybody, which is strange. And there was the weird booby trap where Matt Damon had enough foresight to set a bomb up out of the components of the dismantled robot or something, because it triggers the explosion when they finally get access to the system and find out he's been falsifying things.
Yeah, that was a bit odd.
Yeah, that was not predictable. I mean, I knew Romilly was going to die. I mean, let's face it. It was pretty clear nobody was going to live in this movie except for our main cast. and then only very few of them end up surviving. But the whole thing with, you know, trying to get the ship, the Endurance, I thought that was great with the airlock stuff, because it was like finally this 12-minute long airlock sequence from the beginning of the movie gets it gets some importance, because now we see why we had to sit through that thing where he's lining up the docking port, and that was actually really incredibly effective, and I thought one of my favorite things in the movie is his long speech about how he needs to do this, and then just bam, he's out in space. I love it. He doesn't even finish what he was saying. He's just going on. He's so full of himself, then he's dead.
Yeah, if I would have directed that scene, I would have had a really hard time resisting the urge to have his body bounce off of the windshield of their spaceship.
Yeah, or even it does say something that he was able to have the control to terminate it in the middle of the conversation and not terminate it after the conversation. you know, not to have him have his big speech and then like at the end of a period, just like then it happens. Because I think that wouldn't have been as enjoyable.
Yeah, I don't think there was any intention for Matt Damon to stop talking. He wasn't going to stop trying to talk them away from him, away from the ship until he was in the driver's seat flying away.
Yeah, he's what a nut job.
Yeah, the fly over the ice planet is an interesting point. I'm not sure that their spaceships really had, you know, kind of the cruising capabilities to go like down that hole or whatever. Maybe they just don't really know how to look around or where to look or what they would be looking for without actually getting the data from the scientists down there. Did you see that? Well, probably not. You wouldn't have read it if you had. Somebody posted a like a 7-page graphic novel that I guess was written by the Nolan brothers that explains Dr. Mann's sort of backstory.
Yeah, it's supposed to be on Wired. I didn't read it yet.
Yeah, it's what you would think. It's him getting frustrated and telling the robot to run simulations of what the correct data would be, and the robot going, "Why? What's wrong with you?" And then at the very end, basically, he like shuts the robot down. But it's a little bit of that kind of stuff. But it's mostly just a disgruntled Dr. Mann trying to rationalize his way into falsifying data.
Yeah, I mean, and this is what I get to though is like it's predictable. Like I knew that Dr. Mann was going to screw everything up, and I knew he was going to die, and I knew that the planet was a disaster. But I still love how everything unfolded because Matt Damon is a good actor, and the scenes transpiring occurred appropriately. Intercutting with the Earth scenes was a little strange because I really don't care about Casey Affleck and his family and any of that.
He's just trying to survive, and you can see how the human race is dying every single day because, you know, they got dirt in their lungs, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, he does punch Topher Grace in the face, which is great. But
one thing I will mention, when she comes running out with the watch and, you know, it's like silent or whatever because it's a dramatic moment.
Yeah.
And she's like waving it around going like whatever she's saying, like he's communicating with us. I fully expected Casey Affleck to be pissed off because he realized what they did and hit her with like, I guess Topher Grace had the
tire iron.
I fully expected Casey Affleck to hit her and smash the watch at that point.
No, I didn't think that was going to happen, but the confrontation I felt, I could see artistically why he wanted that confrontation and tension to be paired with the other events that were going on.
Yeah. But, and separate from this movie, that would have been a great moment for this rekindling of the brother and sister who have separated over the course of this 30 years or whatever with a difference in ideology. And she's searching for a way to save humanity and get her dad back. And he's just trying to deal with the reality of Earth. That bridging of the broken relationship is a great moment, but it was completely unfounded because we had none of their backstory, which is another thing that maybe there was more of before, but really was unnecessary at this point.
Yeah. Well, and this is what I get. Why I keep mentioning that the family sense didn't matter to me as much as the father-daughter sense. Because everything relating to Casey Affleck's home life in the scenes on Earth that we see him in is not really super important. It adds flavor, like you're saying, to what's how things are continuing to degrade on Earth and how, unlike his father and unlike his sister, he has settled into the role of the uneducated farmer that the government or whatever wants him to be. That he only sees value in a very small way in the things that are related specifically to the house and his family that has died on the property and the cornfields. Like that is life. So that's good that it is there in a sense, but at the same time, pairing it with the events that are unfolding with Dr. Mann is not comprehensive. Like the two don't balance each other out. I think the way he had thought they would, like the one conflict going on here and one conflict going on there. It's just like, well, these aren't the same. Like they're apples and oranges.
Well, it's a struggle for survival just in different circumstances. I know what you're saying. I'm just, yeah, I am trying to, again, imagine what the thought was.
Well, yeah, but I mean, man is bananas. He's going to kill everybody. Nobody's going to die. None of these characters are going to kill the other characters.
I know. They're all just slowly dying this doomed fate.
Yeah, the Earth is killing them. That's a natural event. So the tension is not equal when you're cutting back and forth.
Yeah. So, certainly not a perfect movie, but I found it interesting. As a large blockbuster, I thought it lived up to everything that I would have wanted it to do. I don't know how often I would revisit this movie. It was an adventure. I certainly didn't see as many things coming as maybe you did, but I enjoyed the experience. It's very... I'm still trying to fully form my opinion on Christopher Nolan. I generally like this movie. There are still a lot of things that he does that are slightly curious, but he's got a language about him that is very apparent in this movie. And when I saw, like I said, when I saw that spherical space station with the Earth or the ground curving up in the background, I just went, "Oh, there we go. That's Christopher Nolan." But I thought he did some cool stuff in this movie. And
they broke that skylight.
The what?
They broke that skylight.
Who broke what skylight?
Remember, they opens up the hospital, and then there's the baseball game going on outside, and then they hit the ball up into the skylight.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, how very clever. And, you know, it was interesting, but it was a little, what was that other Matt Damon with the circular space station and the Jodie Foster thing?
Oh, Elysium. I never saw it.
Little Elysium, but this one's better.
Yeah, no, I didn't see that. Well, I will ask you this though: if you were to compare, let's say, a crazy space movie where it tries to have that gritty, real feeling of stations in space and ships and velocity and stuff, and maybe also another theme like gravity, how would you feel comparing Gravity with Interstellar? Like, does one emotionally impact you more than the other, even though they're both like quiet outer space scenes where things are just flying around?
They feel like completely different movies to me. I can't even put them really in the same category other than them being space. You know, Gravity is really a single character's story and struggle for survival and struggle for meaning in the world that has, you know, sort of betrayed her and she's got problems. This is a larger scale. And again, Christopher Nolan is all about scale visually and in this story. Gravity feels like a much smaller story, despite being still $100 million production or whatever it was. Gravity probably, Gravity, I know for certain, had a lot more tension than this movie. They both had a fair amount of tension, but Interstellar was all over the place with tension and drama and action and all kinds of stuff. I've certainly seen Gravity more times than I've seen Interstellar. The theater experience of Gravity, because I saw it in 3D. No, I didn't see it in 3D, did I? It still made me sweaty palmed and uncomfortable with some of the space scenes, because it very clearly was meant to make you feel uncomfortable, just like Sandra. So I think that was, they did less things in Gravity, but I think they had a little bit more punch. And I think, yeah, restraint is probably the appropriate word. I'm dancing around.
Yeah. And so that's only really the only reason why I bring these two things up, is because I know that they will be discussed together because they're in space and et cetera. The personal stories are totally different though. And the overall theme of the movie is totally different, but the, you know, when it goes up for an Oscar or whatever for visual effects, that people be like, "Oh, like Gravity." Cause that was also a movie with, quiet space stuff and things happening. But I also agree with you. I think tension worked better there in the space scenes than it worked in, Interstellar, cause there was almost no tension in the outer space scenes. With the exception of first crossing through the wormhole and the tension of the docking situation with Dr. Mann coming on board and that not working out so well. And then them trying to dock anyways. At no other point did I feel like in his crash flashback or when they were first landing and he was doing the stupid thing of trying to save fuel and be efficient on the water planet, or it didn't have any intensity to those scenes, because I think, and this might sound a little crazy, but it seems like it didn't have intensity because we were so far removed from what was happening, because he would always frame those shots way out there. So we're looking at some tiny little ship, doing mostly nothing. and like a slow traveling lens flare. And then in Gravity, it's like there's lots of stuff happening. And there's even the sense of you can't even see all of the things that are happening. Something invisible might kill you. And I don't think that kind of comes across in this sort of environment where they're also trying to be gritty and real, but it doesn't have the same, I was going to say Gravity, but I don't want to say it.
At the risk of making this podcast as long as the movie, which would be a terrible idea.
I think that's impossible.
One thing that was brought up on the VFX show that I thought was an interesting point was the way the cameras in Interstellar were sort of strapped to the ships most of the time. So they kind of felt like the kind of footage you would get off of an actual NASA ship. It was kind of done for the purpose of realism. And I know there were some where we were out in space, but for the most part, the cameras were not floating in space. And this movie being, I don't know, Interstellar is probably a terrible title for it, because it's not really so much about space as it is the worlds within the space. And, you know, obviously we have to get through space to get to these places, but Gravity does a great job of, it's more than just the visual, it's a combination of the sound and everything too. The sort of muffled sound of space, the feeling of space, the silence of space was genuinely terrifying in Gravity. The idea of floating around, being that far away from everything, the idea that you could instantly sail away and never be seen or heard from again, being disconnected from the people who are, you know, a quarter of a mile away from you, and you can see them, but you just can't talk to them because radios are down or you can't just communicate. All of that stuff, the small pieces felt more realistic, and the tension was built there in a way that felt very personal in Gravity and actually scared the living hell out of me to ever, the thought of, you know, I hadn't given a lot of thought to what it would be like to go be an astronaut in space. After seeing Gravity, it made me think about it, and the answer is hell no, because it's terrifying. Just the idea of every time they would go to unhook from something and to rehook somewhere else, it's just like, oh, for the love of God. When Sandra Bullock is jumping from place to place because she either had to or she had to go quickly, just like that is, I'm getting scared and sweaty palms thinking about it now, because one false move, you bounce off of that, you are done. And that level of stakes is very small and very personal compared to something like the fate of humankind. But that's the kind of stuff that it gets to me, because it's the one thing happening in your face. It's, oh God, is she going to grab that handhold? Is the air coming out of the airlock going to blow her grip off of the end of that thing? That scares the living crap out of me. And Interstellar, maybe it's the ensemble cast that had something to do with it. Who do you empathize with at which point? Because Anne Hathaway is crying about love, and Matthew McConaughey wants to go back to see his daughter, and Michael Caine wants to save the human race, and all of these things combined kind of leads you all over the place. And there's not these small focused moments of drama and suspense. There's just a lot of it all the time that Gravity kind of is more successful in that regard. So I hope people don't make the Gravity comparison too much, just because they're both space movies. Just because of the fact that Matthew McConaughey wears a space suit in this whole movie doesn't really mean that it is a space movie so much.
No, but I'm just talking about the space scenes. I'm not talking about
any of the space scenes in Interstellar. Like, I don't feel like there was a lot of space scenes comparatively.
Yeah, that's what I mean. There's not a lot of space tension in this movie that is about space, theoretically. And they are ostensibly even more cut off than Sandra Bullock is in a different way. But they feel less cut off because they have that one-way communication.
And they kind of give up on it, too. They're like, well, we're cut off, whereas Sandra Bullock is making space-to-ground calls through, like, a CB radio, and she realizes she's talking to some random guy in a different country, and that's even more heartbreaking. These guys are just sort of like, well, all we got is ourselves and the mission now, so let's keep pushing forward. And you're like, guess we're pushing forward.
Yeah, they are really accepting of their situation with the asymmetrical communications and stuff. That is different. And it makes it feel like they're not really alone, even though there's just four people and two robots. They still feel like they're okay on that thing. Like, even when that one guy is by himself the whole entire time and we join back up with him, he's like, oh, I thought all of you were dead. And it was like such a big deal, but it didn't feel like a big deal. Cause we weren't seeing him or anything about his life. We know almost nothing about Romilly other than he gets basic. This is such an underdeveloped character, considering the number of people in this film. And so there's no space tension.
I think the one strange thing we're kind of discounting in this comparison is, all right, we go with Gravity and we go with what is every single bit of reality that we can put into this, mixed with some story and some filmmaking skill to make it presentable and interesting. That's all real. That's all realistic stuff that could potentially happen to a human being. It's a little outlandish, but it's all real. Interstellar is a work of fantasy, and I applaud Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan for writing something like this, because it is bananas in terms of a story. It is out there. It's a space adventure, and it's a completely different class of writing and storytelling that's impressive. Like, I look at something like this, like Interstellar, and I go, I can never write that. If I were to try and write Gravity, I would mix in a lot of science and a lot of accuracy, and I know a lot of people applaud Gravity for its accuracy, and I would try and fit a story to that. This movie seems to just sort of say, what is the most cinematic, largest scale story we can possibly tell, and then we use these components to build it. So I still don't have the correct way to put it, but when I talk about the scale of the movies Christopher Nolan likes to make, that's what I'm talking about with this like fantasy world and plot line that is outlandish and out there and impressive, just in the sense that like I could never have thought this movie up, and I like that because it's a skill that I don't have particularly well developed, but it's a different class of movie, and it's I enjoy that it exists.
Okay.
You got any other thoughts, or you want to button this up?
Let's button it up.
Space tension. You done?
You just can't reach me on the other end of the wormhole.
Oh, God. That's a good ending.
No, it isn't.
Till you all just disappear.